The Gist is brought to you by Goldman Sachs. Get information about developments currently shaping markets, industries, and the global economy on the firm's podcast, Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, available on iTunes. And by Betterment, the largest automated investing service managing billions of dollars for people just like you. Get up to 6 months of investing free when you go to betterment.com/gist. Betterment, investing made better.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
It's Tuesday, April 26, 2016. From Slate, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. The Saudis are getting out of the oil business in a big way. An oil kingdom plans to wean itself from oil is the headline in the Washington Post. Now, here's the problem. That word wean. Wean doesn't just mean give up. It means to swap one substance for another. You wean off the teat and you start to eat and drink adult food, for instance, or you wean yourself from dessert, but maybe you replace it with a fruit. I think what Saudi Arabia might be doing or hoping to do is more of starving, oilrexia, if you will, because if you look at the other businesses in Saudi Arabia that they could possibly lean on, well, the Wall Street Journal helpfully had a chart. 40% of their economics are based on crude oil and natural gas. But everything else is, well, you know how with Chinese fortune cookies, you can amend every fortune with the phrase in bed, like your everlasting patience will be rewarded sooner or later in bed. Something you lost will soon turn up in bed. May life throw you a pleasant curve. In bed. With Saudi Arabia, their economy can all be amended with for oil, like 40% is crude oil and natural gas, 14% government services for oil, then there's manufacturing for oil, then there's insurance for oil, and then there's wholesale, retail, and hospitality for people who made money on oil. They are an extremely oil-based economy. How oil-based? How oleaginous? So, the CIA lists the export of every country, and Saudi Arabia, here's how they list their exports. Petroleum, 90%. Let's take the other S's around Saudi Arabia. Senegal has fish, groundnuts, petroleum products, phosphates, and cotton. Serbia, iron and steel, rubber, clothes, wheat, fruit and vegetables, non-ferrous metals, electric appliances, metal products, weapons and ammunition. Yay, automobiles. That's Serbia. What a diversified economy. Even San Marino, building stone, lime, wood, chestnuts, wheat, wine, baked goods, hides, and ceramics. Now, San Marino is a small country within Italy. So when they say one of their major exports is hide, I mean, if Giuseppe's cow didn't die that year, hide's going to plummet by 50%. But still, it's a more diversified economy than Saudi Arabia, which couldn't be more dependent on oil. The Prince Mohammed of Saudi Arabia says, quote, by 2020, we'll be able to live without oil. And he's dubbed his plan Saudi Vision 2030. So they're really on the same page in soon to be oil-free Saudi Arabia. Unless sand is selling for $80 a barrel, they are screwed. On the show today, I spiel about the five states about to vote and the two men who mangled their already impossible chances of pulling off a victory. Now, one man who I'm going to say will be victorious, his name is Donald Trump. And tomorrow, in this space, we're going to bring you a version of the Trump cast because I have to take a day off. On today's show, I call up my favorite art historian in Slovenia, but first, why is America's infrastructure problem so expensive? So the other day I was talking to my barber who is on Second Avenue, and we were talking about the Second Avenue subway, or as he calls it, the Second Avenue giant pile of dirt that never stops digging outside his window. And I said to him, well, you have to put up with the headache now, but when it's done, you're going to have plenty of business. And he looked at me and said, yeah. But he didn't really have a smile. And then it hit me. Oh, wait, they're going to jack up your rents right afterwards. Oh, yeah. Infrastructure and money, the two go together. Sure, you need infrastructure to spur the economy, but just how much it costs is a vexing problem. Justin Fox is a columnist who writes about business for Bloomberg View. And he tried to answer the question why U.S. infrastructure costs so much. Hey, Justin.
Hey, I failed miserably, didn't I?
Well, it's a conundrum. And you start off on the point of saying, you know, people can agree on infrastructure more or less. Republicans and Democrats, you know, even Donald Trump perhaps the least radical thing he says is he wants to build all these projects and all this infrastructure. But of course, it does cost a lot. In fact, it seems like it costs more than it should. So before we get to the why, can you document the, let's say, out of control or at least huge cost for some of our infrastructure projects?
Well, the main area where there seems to be a lot of comparative data that people have been gathering over the last couple of years is rail projects, subways and other rail projects. And basically, costs in the U.S. seem to come out dramatically higher than even in pretty affluent European countries. I mean, I guess it's no big surprise that it costs more to build a new subway line in under Second Avenue than it does in Wuhan in China. But also in Madrid, the subway tunneling there was just dramatically cheap of kind of disasters.
So it's we are being New York centric, but of course, D.C. has a massive need for a subway, which Congress actually recently denied them. There was the big dig in Boston. L.A. is doing a lot of stuff. Obviously, it's not just one thing, but what's the biggest culprit that you found in these costs?
One area that's actually kind of promising in the areas of explanations is that overall, worldwide, when you're looking at these rail projects, common law, English language speaking countries, England, you know, UK, Australia, US, Canada, we cost more than non-common law countries. Mm-hmm. And it's basically because our legal systems are more protective of property rights for the most part.
It's interesting, though, there's an irony in that the very type of politician that will be railing against big government and will be emphasizing property rights, one of the reasons that he's railing against big government is because of the cost. Well, it's your defense of property rights that's driving up the cost.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, and very often this is something that, I mean, I'm sure politicians can try to take it on, but it's just the way our legal system has evolved. That and another thing that has happened, and again, you know, lots of other countries came in with environmental regulations in the 70s and 80s, but the particular way we have chosen to do it in this country also emphasizes litigation.
Yes.
And, oh, you got to do an environmental impact study, and then people can sue to slow it down.
But then again, there's, okay, in the UK, where a cost per ride's $2, expressed in dollars, $2.61. These are stats from your article. In London, that's in London. In Paris, it's $1.93 per ride. In New York, it's over $4 a ride. And one reason is that when you hire the people to staff the trains and to build the trains, you're not only paying those people, you're paying their healthcare and you're paying their pensions. Whereas France and the UK, the government is always paying their pension. The government's paying.
Right. And actually, in the UK, the government's not paying it. But for whatever reason, and I don't know the UK pension system very well, but it's not nearly as generous as the pension benefits that transit workers can get in the U.S. Now, what we're talking about now is the cost of operating a system, not right. of building it. And it's basically, I focused on that because there's this brand new report from Moody's comparing the financial state of the transit systems in London, Paris, and New York. And one thing that was kind of funny is they were pretty positive on New York because ridership is growing really fast in New York. And in Paris, it isn't. London, it's doing okay. But yeah, when they looked at those costs, and one reason was the cost of healthcare and of retirement benefits. Another one, which is kind of interesting, is that the New York, the MTA, which covers the subway in New York, also includes all these commuter lines out to Long Island and up to Westchester County and such. And those trains have much higher staffing than a subway train does. So in the Moody's report, they said, so they're not strictly comparable. But I read something else by Stephen Smith, who writes a lot in New York about transit issues. He's the editor of something called New York YIMBY for Yes in My Backyard.
Trying too hard with that title, maybe.
It's kind of a thing these days. So he wrote a piece actually for Bloomberg View a couple years ago that I happened across while Googling that sort of made the point that the whole way that commuter trains work in U.S. metropolitan areas where you have like four conductors walking through the chains,
right,
checking every single person's ticket is like no place else in the world does it that way anymore. There are much more efficient ways that don't take nearly as many people. And I don't know, you know, that's partly unions pushing for that. It's partly just, I think, local transit authorities not wanting to deal with the hassle of trying to change it.
Yeah.
But that's like this big cost factor that basically no other developed country has.
There's one thing about infrastructure as a topic, as a political topic. It's sometimes asserted that, you know, it's not sexy or infrastructure is important but boring. Is it really boring? I mean, when Eisenhower built the interstate highways, wasn't he seen as heroic? And don't all politicians like putting their name on a bridge or at
least
going to...
Yeah, people love bridges. Yeah. Tunnels are a little harder, but bridges, people love
but
that.
Highways? I mean, that's tangible. Of all the things government pays for, wouldn't you want to pay for a road that you could name as opposed to, say, servicing debt?
I think part of the issue is that up through the 1950s, building infrastructure was building... maybe bridges, but also a lot of railways, transit type things. From then on, it was all about building roads and sort of connecting the cities out to the suburbs. And everybody sort of agreed. I think there was widespread agreement in the early 20th century that, yes, we need more subway lines. We need, and there was widespread agreement in the 50s through 2000 that, yes, we need more highways. I think what we've got now is this sort of big question of, well, is it more highways that we need? Or is it sort of restructuring our big metropolitan areas so they're not quite as highway centric? And I think that's where you get a lot, you actually do get this big partisan divide there. Everybody, Republicans, Democrats say, yes, we need more infrastructure. And maybe when it comes to like sewage treatment plants, they agree. Although I think we need a lot of those still too. Yeah. So, because that's not as sexy to have your name on, I guess.
Put your enemy's name on it.
In the Republican Party, it's mostly about infrastructure means money to build roads. And in the Democratic Party, there's a lot of people who just even say no to roads.
Yeah.
And it's all about transit. The Republicans are dubious of most transit projects, sometimes with good reason, sometimes because of this sort of weird anti-urban bias.
And the cities can't do it all themselves. I mean, the MTA needs at least state funding, and the federal dollars are really important, too.
I mean, and they're doing a lot more. Like in LA and the San Francisco area, it really is mostly being funded by people voting to levy higher taxes on themselves. But yes, to coordinate and make it happen, federal and state money comes in handy too.
And by the way, how's that high-speed rail going in California? I hear bad things. I hear cost, and I hear it's not going to go fast enough because everyone wants a station in their front yard and it doesn't let the train go fast enough.
Yeah. I mean, my number one answer to that would be, I'm not sure. My number two is people are going to complain like heck at this stage of it. I think almost anything they build will be a nice addition. Again, I don't know what the long term, how you measure cost and benefit. I'm looking forward to riding the train through the middle of Central Valley instead of having to drive my car for 4 hours on the most boring highway in America.
Justin Fox is a columnist writing about business for Bloomberg View. Prior to joining Bloomberg View, I see he's written for The American Banker and Time and Fortune, but also the Advance Register of Tulare, California, where he was the farm editor.
It didn't
come up here, but maybe one day it will.
I hope so.
The Gist is brought to you by Goldman Sachs. For answers to the world's most pressing economic questions, from the latest in emerging markets to finding the next big computing platform, tune into Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, the firm's podcast. Each episode features in-depth discussions with some of the firm's leading experts on the markets, evolving industries, and the global economy. Subscribe to Exchanges at Goldman Sachs on iTunes, Stitcher, or SoundCloud. Or listen at gs.com/podcast.
If you listen to this show, you know that I like the painter Hieronymus Bosch. Some people say Boss, maybe if you were Dutch or something, but what are we going to go Van Gogh on you? So I like Bosch and I like analogies. And I was reading an article which represented the confluence of the two. Check this out. Liminal zones or beings occupy the narrow space between two opposites, a bit of both, wholly neither. Twilight is the liminal time between day and night. Venice is a liminal city between aquatic and terrestrial. A centaur is a liminal being, half horse, half human. A cronut is a liminal snack. Which brings us to that author, Noah Charney's ideas about why we like Hieronymus Bosch. Noah Charney is the author of The Art Thief and is the founder of the Association for Research into Crimes Against Art. Hello, Noah.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So there is this concept called the uncanny valley in animation where you create a human-looking figure who's too close to human, and we don't like it. There's something freakish about it. And something like that is going on with Bosch, in your estimation, right?
That's right. To understand why Bosch is so effective and really creeps us out, you have to understand the background he's coming from. And his works look fantastical with these hybrid monsters in it, but there's an element of realism to it. And that might sound funny because these days we think depictions of things like hell and hybrid monsters must be completely fantastical. But you have to understand that, you know, circa 1500, when Bosch was living and painting, the concept of hell was very real. And so his landscapes and what he's most famous for are these burnt territories full of demons inflicting ironic tortures on the damned. And they're often to do with the sin committed by the person when he was alive. He's punished in an ironic manner based on that sin in the afterlife. And he's also got these hybrid creatures that are either half human, half animal, or a combination of two animals, like a rabbit with porcupine quills, for example. And that hybridization is something that really sticks with us and that we find uncanny and creepy. It really haunts us.
Liminal. So is part of it, though, part of the distancing, why we think of it as obviously fantastical and maybe people at the time didn't, is that just in terms of art, our understanding of drawing the figure, drawing the human, has progressed so much. But if you looked at art from 1500 or the late 1400s, humans would not be drawn so much differently than some of his demons are in his works.
That is a good point, but one of the things that is a more radical theory about Bosch's art is that he was intentionally choosing to be a bit more of a caricaturist than he was capable of. Around the same time, circa 1500, artists in southern Europe, like Raphael, Michelangelo, Leonardo, were capable of incredibly accurate depictions of humans. And if you look at one of Bosch's most famous predecessors, someone I actually have a book I've written about, Jan van Eyck, he was extremely realistic in his portrayals. And Bosch could have been realistic if he wanted to, but he was choosing something that was sort of a dark, shadowy nightmare version of what we encounter in real life, intentionally inhabiting that liminal zone.
I think that part of the creepiness is also that it comes unexpectedly in a number of places. It's not even so much that the demons that are meant to be fierce freak me out in a fun and good way. It's the humans with the fish parts, specifically the fish parts. Those are the weirdest, where you don't expect, there's no fangs, there's no claws, but it's I don't know why mermaids are fun, but his fish people are totally unfun.
There's a lot of that, and one of the things that you mentioned, actually, you have to look up close, and one of the things that may surprise people who only see Bosch images in a book or online, they're very small with lots of tiny details, and it forces you to get right up next to them. If he had one of his figures, like his hybrid fish head with person legs, as a very large figure standing alone in a field, it would look almost silly. But he has this plethora of, you know, dozens of figures that are buried in little details in a large landscape scene. And you have to look close. And so they stumble on you and they almost surprise you. It's kind of like a horror movie where if you see the bad guy in full broad daylight, full screen, you're like, okay. But if it's going very creepily through shadows and you glimpse something out of the corner of your eye, it's much more effective. And he forces you to do that by painting on a small scale.
Do you think the smallness gives him an advantage over Michelangelo in The Last Judgment, the famous scene of torture and damnation in the Sistine Chapel?
Yeah, it gives him an advantage. Also, he had the luxury of not having to fulfill the commission with a pope looking over his shoulder. And he was painting, largely on commission. He did altar pieces. He sold quite a bit to private collectors like Philip II of Spain. But he was doing things on a smaller scale, more intimate. He didn't have to do the sort of grandiose project that would have very specific expectations and requirements like most of his Italian counterparts did, who were working on commission for large public spaces with contracts that really specified what they could and couldn't paint.
So do you think, we don't know about Bosch's motivations. Was he trying to capture the dream state, or do you think that he just, I mean, you mentioned Jung, you mentioned Freud. Did he stumble upon the same things that animate the creepiness of dreams and nightmares?
It depends who you ask, and we don't want to be anachronistic about it, but Jung would have said that he was tapping into a collective unconscious archetype that exists in all cultures to a certain extent, and he's just pulling it out, probably unconsciously, things that he had dreamt about or he could imagine, but that he was tapping into something universal that resonates with us today, even though we're in a very different era and civilization. But if you asked him during his time, he would say, and he actually writes this as a quote in one of his paintings, I'm going to paraphrase, but it basically says that it's a shame for people to copy what others had already done, and it's most honorable to invent something wholly new.
Noah Charney is the founder of the Association for Research into Crimes Against Art. His writing on Hieronymus Bosch appears in Salon. Bosch is having the 500th anniversary of his death. And whereas with a lot of artists, we celebrate a 100th anniversary or 500th of their life, with Bosch, we don't know when he was born. And really, isn't death the more appropriate one to celebrate? Thank you so much, Noah.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So everything you do, I mean, convenience now pretty much is intertwined with the internet. I don't know, maybe if you're a canoeist or a cabinet maker, untrue, but I bet you're on ecanoe.com. The e prefix, that used to be a big thing, now not so much. Anyway, we've disrupted the canoe space enough. But think about finance. There are sites out there that will let you trade stocks, but what about if you want to just get control of your wealth, such as it is, if you want to plan for retirement, if you just want to get on top of things, but you're comfortable with the internet, you're comfortable with an app, interfaces that are online are even preferable to you. You don't want to hire a guy necessarily, go into his office, you know, look at his suit that probably should have been swapped out 11 years ago. Well, there's a great app for you, and it's called Betterment. It allows you to take control of your financial future. It has 150,000 customers. They're managing over $4 billion in money for people like you. And people like you are people who maybe listen to podcasts and wouldn't mind to have a low-cost way of managing their finances. And the feeling of just that you've got a grasp of this thing, this really important thing, like why you work every day is this thing I'm talking about, Betterment. You can get up to 6 months of automated investing free, and you could also find out more information when you go to betterment.com/gist. That's betterment.com/gist. It makes investing easier at a lower cost. Betterment, investing made better. And now the spiel, throwing the brakes on the Acela. We learned a lot about the voting in five states today, the so-called Acela primary.
This is being called the Acela primary. That's because Amtrak's famous Acela train heads right through all the states voting today. Maryland, Pennsylvania, Connecticut, Rhode Island, as well as the state of Delaware.
That's just a hallmark of a good moniker that you gotta explain it. Come on down to Sleepy's Mattresses, because sleep is what you do on a mattress. So we called it Sleepy's. Anyway, the so-called Acela primary.
The so-called Acela primary. This primary is for states that run along.
It doesn't work. It just doesn't. It's not only clunky. This primary does not include New York, New Jersey. So some of the states that the Acela line runs on, and you can't get from Maryland to Connecticut without going through those states that aren't having a primary in this so-called Acela primary. I mean, really, it's not the Acela primary. It's at best the so-called Acela primary.
What you really see in tonight's, what we're calling the Acela corridor primaries is...
Ha! But if you really want to laugh, we learned something because of the so-called Acela primary. We learned that the Kasich-Cruz alliance, the pact between the second and third Republican candidates, is a pact in the sense that a murder-suicide pact is a pact. It's never going to work, and neither one is going to survive. Here's the two guys who are involved in this don't vote for him in Oregon, don't vote for that guy in Indiana scheme.
A vote for Cruz or Trump, frankly, is a vote for Hillary Clinton.
John Kasich has no path whatsoever to the nomination.
Ted Cruz is the guy who was likened to being poisoned. Lindsey Graham said that. He said the choice between Trump and Cruz is like being shot or poisoned. I would have said it's like the choice between being choked or strangled, because choked you can live with, strangled is to die from choking. So, you know, Cruz wasn't going to work well with others. But actually, the evidence is it's more Kasich who isn't playing by the rules of the pact, such as they are. Simply telling voters in Indiana, He's supposed to say, no, vote for Cruz. Instead, he's saying, yeah, vote for me. I mean, Kasich's a politician. He wants you to vote for him. And he's looking at the other two guys and he says, the grandest thing I could do as an American, the most I can contribute to democracy, is to get in the way of these two guys. And, you know, as far as that goes, I think he's correct. I do support the pact, though, and I'll tell you why. Because the pact has given us a gift. And the gift is what's coming out of Donald Trump's mouth. We have learned that the best word that Donald Trump can say isn't fired, isn't huge, it's collude.
In politics, you're allowed to collude. So they colluded, and actually I was happy because it shows how weak they are. It shows how pathetic they are.
In other questionable pronunciation news, Richard Thaler, who's the top behavioral economist ever, he tweeted, cooperation is hard when you hate your partner. Defect is the likely outcome. Now, I have to tell you, I read this not as defect, like a game theory choice. I'm going to defect and he will defect. I read it as defect. And yes, when speaking of Cruz and Kasich, defect, in fact, does describe the relationship and the choices pretty well. But what are we going to call this Acela primary? I mean, I was trying to rebrand it. You're welcome, America. So what do the states have in common? Well, the three smallest states are voting, Rhode Island, Delaware, and Connecticut. But then you got the fairly sizable Pennsylvania, so that ruins the tiny primary. I like the teensy primary. Then I was looking at educational attainment by graduate degree, Maryland's second, Connecticut's third, Rhode Island's 10th, Delaware's 12th. Pennsylvania's not that smart. And you couldn't call it the smarty pants primary because Trump's going to win. So then I started looking at the states, their postal codes, MDRICTPADE, and I started generating some anagrams. And a couple of them really work, like the style of the candidates, Sanders and Cruz and Kasich. It could be the tad crimp primary. They are a tad crimped. Or if you look at what happened to the Kasich-Cruz Accord, Mr. Pact died primary. This, of course, is trying too hard. Then I realized, oh, these five states, they were five of the original 13 colonies. In fact, they were colony number 1, 2, 5, 7, and 13. Well, what can I do with that? I put it through Google. 1, 2, 5, 7, 13. Those numbers come up with a bunch of interesting items, like on ShadesDaddy.com, there's some Versace sunglasses, bin number 125713, the shady primary, that could work. There's a half-zip textured knit pullover, that's item number 125713. At Bustle.com, article 125713 is how getting dressed as a non-binary individual is a political act. That totally describes the debate about bathrooms that we're having. And I think I got it when I figured out this, that in Kentucky, unknown water well ID number 125713 is an unknown groundwater well. It's in Hopkinsville County. I think it's a perfect analogy for the primary. We're in a hole. It's scary. Politics are an echo chamber. And somehow Donald Trump's going to get the Mexicans to pay for it. There was a bunch of cows listed in the American Hereford Cow Record Book, a cow named Lucille, a cow named Lady Benji, a cow named Lady Jessie. They were all number 125713. We could name it the Lady Jessie the Cow Primary. But then I came across this, Best's Flitcraft Compendium. And what the Best Flitcraft Compendium is, it's a book by the AM Best Company, and they bought Flitcraft, I believe, in the 1940s, and it gives ratings about insurance. Then I was thinking of Flitcraft. Do you know the story of Flitcraft? So this is what fans of film noir call the Flitcraft parable. I'm going to tell it to you. It occurs in The Maltese Falcon, in the novel, not in the movie. So Flitcraft was a real estate agent in Tacoma, Washington. He lived well. He had a wife. He had kids. He had good income. He had money. He would go golfing at 4 o'clock. And then one day he just disappears, poof, out of the air. Sam Spade says he went like that, like a fist when you open your hand. So what happened one day? He was walking down the street in Tacoma, and a huge beam falls from a building feet from where Flitcraft was walking. And he lived. He survived. He wasn't even scathed. But in that moment, he realized that none of what he had, the wife, the kids, the income, the money, none of that mattered. And he just disappeared, fell off the grid. Sam Spade, the detective, follows him. And 5 years later, he finds Flitcraft. Only now he's not Flitcraft. He's Charles Peirce, which is probably a reference to Charles Sanders Peirce, a philosopher who was a pioneer of semiotics. Flickcraft, or Pierce, is doing well. He's comfortable. He's prosperous. He lives in Spokane. He's got a new job. He's got a new wife. He's got a new baby. Very similar to his old wife. He just started anew based on almost getting hit by that beam. Different job, different family, different town. And the story, the parable ends in the Maltese Falcon. He adjusted himself to beams falling, and then no more of them fell, and he adjusted himself to them not falling. The Flickcraft parable is a fascinating part of the Maltese Falcon, but it also stops the book dead. And as it stops the book dead, the characters in the book are wondering, why is this book or why is this story stopped dead? And it's a story that stands for the greater character of the characters telling it. Just changing on a dime, your essential character changing based on chance events. That is an analogy for politics if I ever heard it. So the Flickcraft primary, that, though obscure, is at least as good as the Acela. And that's it for today's show. Andrea Salenzi is the Gist's producer. She's been at the job a while, yet she still has a temp ID card. Steve Lickteig, executive producer of Slate Podcast, is totally bald. Do you want to know why? It's because he was a perm addict. Andy Bowers, chief content officer of the Panoply Network, he has to sift through a lot of proposed podcasts. Yes, he did met crap. You know, tomorrow, I'm taking a day off. Thing about the Acela primary for me, took an Acela down to D.C., did a live show, taking an Acela back today. So tomorrow, we're going to bring you a very special TrumpCast collaboration right here in this space. The Gist, sorry we won't be here tomorrow. Your reaction? I predict mad. Peru, and thanks for listening.